Our Boston. Weekdays starting at noon on AM 580.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're focusing today on the final major rulings by the U.S. Supreme Court this term. The court ruled in favor of a challenge to the Affordable Care Act by a privately held craft store named Hobby Lobby, whose owners objected on religious grounds to offering birth control coverage for their employees as required by the health care law. The court's decision will allow certain businesses to refuse to offer this coverage, and in another decision, the justices allowed some public sector employees to opt out of paying union dues, even if they receive the benefits of collective bargaining. The court was closely divided along ideological lines with 5-4 rulings in each case. We wanted to talk about both of these decisions and their broader implications. So we've called David Savage once again. He's the Supreme Court reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Michelle.
And for perspective on the labor issue, we've also called Stephen Pitts. He's a labor policy expert at the Labor Center of the University of California, Berkeley. Mr. Pitts, thank you for joining us as well.
Thanks for having me on the show.
And we're going to stand by and ask you to stand by, Mr. Pitts, for a minute, because we're going to focus first on that Hobby Lobby case. So, David, what kinds of companies can opt out of providing birth control coverage as a result of this ruling? I'm interested in this question of how broad it really is, because a lot of the analysts seem to disagree about that.
So I guess we don't really know how broad it's going to be. I think the general idea is if you're a corporation and the owners have what they say is a sincerely held religious belief that they don't want to do this, they can opt out. So I think it's pretty broad, at least in theory. Practically speaking, you can't imagine a lot of big corporations in the country that have a lot of, you know, say, public shareholders and a wide board of directors. They're probably not going to say, hey, this is not a good idea for business to be able to tell our women employees. But I think a lot of companies where it's a family, it's essentially a family-run company or family-run, in this case, chain of stores, yes, they can, if they choose to, say, we're not going to offer this because it violates our religious beliefs.
So is this decision, in fact, limited to privately held corporations? Because I'm just trying to figure out how, in a publicly held scenario where a company is owned by the shareholders who may have a wide variety of religious beliefs, how is a religious sincerity test to be determined? So is this, in fact, limited to people, to concerns like Hobby Lobby, which are privately held?
Yes, I think that's right. It's a privately held corporation, and even more so, probably a family-run corporation, because even some privately run corporations have a bunch of people who are the shareholders.
Do you anticipate other challenges to the law based on this ruling? I mean, are there, for example, other cases in the pipeline where people are waiting to see what happened in this case?
Yes, two kinds. There are a whole lot of cases out there, by the way, that are still pending that are religiously affiliated institutions, schools, colleges. Those are all still pending. But I also think, I mean, we don't know down the road, but I do think this sort of opens a new door. The court has essentially never said this before. So they've sort of opened this door to saying that if you as the owner have some deeply held religious belief, you can invoke that and say, I deserve an exemption from the law.
And do you anticipate that there are challenges to other areas of the law beyond the Affordable Care Act? Or do you think that that is specific to the Affordable Care Act because implicate matters of health and religion are implicated? For example, I mean, Hillary Clinton in a public address talked about, you know, what about people who have religious objections to blood transfusions, you know, for example? That's still a health area. Do you anticipate going beyond the health area? Are there challenges?
Yes, I do think down the road, it's not going to happen immediately, but I think in the next couple of years, you're going to see a lot more of these types of cases. Because as I say, they've sort of introduced a new principle in the law, because the law has always been that if you go into a public business, you've got to abide by the laws. That's what the whole principle of the Civil Rights Act is. If you go into business, then you have to abide by the Civil Rights Act. This is sort of heading the law in a different direction of saying, well, no, in some instances, owners can invoke their religious beliefs, and we don't know, but my guess is down the road, yes, there'll be other types of cases, other laws challenged.
Let's hear about the other court decision in Harris versus Quinn. In this ruling, the justices said that home health care workers in Illinois who didn't want to join the union shouldn't be forced to pay dues. And just briefly, again, you know, there's the question of whether this is a broad ruling or a limited one with other implications. David, tell us your perspective on this.
Well, I think it's both. I think it has an effect immediately in this area of home health care, because this was sort of a growing area. These were underpaid, very often underpaid poorly treated workers who were working in people's houses. They were paid from Medicare funds, but they were going to say, take care of adult disabled people who were living at home. The union went in. Their wages have doubled over the last few years, brought them a lot of benefits. But, you know, a lot of people don't like unions, and they had a few members who objected. And so this, I think, will make it harder for those unions to organize home health care workers. In addition, the court's opinion is full of language questioning the whole notion of mandatory fees for, let's say, school teachers, public transit workers. All those public transit, all those public unions since the mid-70s have been able to say, look, if you're going to benefit from the collective bargaining and the benefits the union bring, you have to pay some fair share, everybody. The court's opinion doesn't overrule those precedents, but Justice Alito has a lot of skeptical language that suggests down the road that's where the court's headed.
Stephen Pitts, the court ruled that home health care workers were not, quote-unquote, full-fledged public employees because they are hired and fired by individual patients, even though they are paid in part by the state through Medicaid. Are there other jobs that this may apply to?
Well, I think if you go into the area of child care, it's very similar. That could happen. And what you have here is it's a broad range of areas. Say home care is one for adults, child care is another. Where in an attempt to provide better care for consumers, you begin to have this kind of quasi-public, quasi-private situation where the dollars paying the workers come from the state, while oftentimes some of the initial interactions between the consumer and the individual worker, him or herself. And so all these areas, you find a situation where this kind of duality exists. And the Supreme Court's majority did set up this new category called partial public employees.
Hmm. Do you see broader implications for this case as well, Stephen Pitts, based on your analysis of the circumstances as well as the ruling itself?
I mean, definitely. It's very clear that Alito really does not like the Abood precedent. Kind of the legal, what's governing this is the Abood versus Detroit Board of Education ruling back in 1977 that allowed for public sector unions to establish an agency fee that would disallow individuals from receiving benefits from a union collective bargaining action when I pay for those services. And Alito really said basically that the ruling in 77 was faulty. And so clearly he both said that in this particular case, Abood should not be extended, but he opened the door for future challenges to Abood that, in his mind, hopefully they would overrule the entire case and basically gut the public sector unions.
What's the critical feature of this, Stephen Pitts, that you want us to focus on? What's the critical aspect of this case that you think has implications for the future? Is it the type of work? Is it the type of payment structure that governs the work? What is it that's relevant here?
Where there's two important things. From the point of view of workers, it's very important to understand that workers need to come together to help collectively bargain to improve their conditions. And the basic danger there is one of having a free rider. So in the case of Illinois, without the union, the wages that those workers would receive would be a minimum wage. Today in Illinois, it would be $7.25 an hour. Because of the contract, in December, it would rise to $13 an hour, a clear benefit to the worker. That couldn't occur without the collective action on the part of workers themselves. To the extent that a worker could receive that benefit, might pay for it, they begin to opt out, it weakened the capacity of unions to operate in the interest of workers and would begin to see a race to the bottom. That's one thing. The second important thing is from the point of view of consumers. Because once again, the development of these home care workers has allowed people who might normally be in institutions to be at home, which is a positive thing. And we've seen that through higher wages, there have been less worker turnover and therefore higher quality of care for the consumers as well. So from both standpoints, you see an adverse impact on both workers and consumers.
David, interesting. What do we know about these eight plaintiffs? I mean, do we know, did they have an individual antipathy toward union membership? They felt that it interfered with what their free right of association. What was their kind of motivation? Since they're clearly, I think they're not denying that they achieved a benefit.
Some of it is antipathy, but some of them is a very personal situation. I've talked to a number of them. That some of these are mothers who are raising their own, caring for their own adult disabled child at home. Mm-hmm. They have a child who's 30 years old now, disabled, and that person is working at home. And they basically think, What good does – they don't feel any connection to the union. You know, they work in their own home. It's not like working in a school or, at a transit agency. They don't feel any connection to the union. They say, I've got to pay fees, and so they really just don't like the union. There's also the National Right to Work Committee is willing to send in lawyers to fight these cases. So if you have a couple plaintiffs, you can take on a big – you only need a couple plaintiffs to take on a big union and make a big case out of it.
David, just give us the same question I asked Professor Pitts earlier, which is, do you see broader implications or are there cases that this precedent might affect coming down the road?
Well, I agree with Professor Pitts on this, that the big issue in unions is everybody has to be together. For the union movement to work, everybody has to join and participate and pay. If you inject the principle into the law that everybody has a right to opt out and not pay, unions really fear that that's the first start of crippling the unions. It wouldn't happen immediately, but if you can undercut the principle that everyone has to pay their fair share, it will really undercut the unions.
Just very briefly, Professor Pitts, we only have about a minute left. You know, the fact is that unions represent a declining share of the labor force anyway, so I think some might argue, how could it really have that significant effect when it's a minority of the labor force now that's unionized? Your thoughts?
The issues in the union is the quality of work for the workers themselves. And we see with the rising concern of inequality, we need to take steps to raise the quality of work for workers in our society. And unions are an important strategy to do that. And so when we begin to erode the power of unions, you're actually eroding the living standards of a large number of Americans.
But you heard David Savage say that they didn't feel a connection to the union. So was there a failure of outreach or a failure of the union to make its benefits known to these workers?
I mean, unions can do better. As I said before, though, without the union there, they would have received less monies. And they might have had actually, given the old situation, they might have had their family members in institutions themselves.
Stephen Pitts is an associate chair of the Labor Center at UC Berkeley. He joined us from member station KQED in San Francisco. David Savage is a Supreme Court reporter for the Los Angeles Times. He was with us in our Washington, D.C. studios. Thank you both so much for speaking to us.
Thanks, Michelle.
Thank you.
Coming up, for a lot of teens, summer means kicking back from the ABCs, but it can also be a time to learn about how to handle money.
You can say save, 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 but they may choose not to. If they fail, let them fail, but do not try to pick up the pieces for them.
Money coach Alvin Hall offers financial tips for teens. That's next on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Most of the fish we eat in the U.S. is imported, yet much of the fish we catch here is exported. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Paul Greenberg about this seafood deficit and its implications for our health and the health of our economy and the oceans. Greenberg is the author of American Catch, The Fight for Our Local Seafood. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Tune in to WILL-TV and celebrate Independence Day with A Capital Fourth. Hosted by Tom Bergeron, the program features a patriotic evening of musical performances by some of the country's best-known musicians, along with the National Symphony Orchestra. Broadcast live from the West Lawn of the U.S. Capitol, A Capital Fourth also presents the most spectacular fireworks display anywhere in the nation. Watch A Capital Fourth, Friday night at 7 on WILL-TV.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. By this time, you're probably settling into a summer routine. For a lot of people, that means trips to the beach or the pool. If you have a child, especially a daughter, who seems very concerned with how her body looks right now, and swimsuit season is pushing that button even more, we hope you'll stick around for a parenting conversation later this hour, because we're going to talk about how to deal with that. But first, we were thinking about the fact that for a lot of teens, summer means a first job, and this could be a good opportunity to hear some lessons about financial management and discipline. I sat down with money coach Alvin Hall earlier to talk about this, and I asked whether parents should have a conversation with the teen about how the money will be used before the job starts.
Yes, they should be having a conversation about the importance of saving money. You can spend part of what you own, but you need to also save part of the money you earn so that you can build something toward the future. Most parents think that kids are fairly naive about money or learning the lessons early on, but in reality, kids have been observing the parents' actions all along. And talking about savings and making it as a priority is very important.
You know, there are people who have the argument that letting your kid make the wrong choices about money are just kind of figured out for themselves, particularly with that summer paycheck, is really the best way to let them figure it out for themselves. Because if they say blow it all on sneakers in the first week and then have to borrow money for the bus, then that's a powerful lesson. What do you say to that?
I say that is a powerful lesson, and they're going to make that mistake whether you are on message or not. So you can say save, 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 but they may choose not to. If they fail, let them fail, but do not try to pick up the pieces for them because they will gain the wisdom for that failure. But it's important, Michelle, for the parents to be consistent in the message that they give the child.
Well, what do you mean by that? Like, tell me a little bit more about that.
Although the child may not be saving, you need to say, why aren't you saving? You know, this is important. You can spend part of your money. You can save part of your money. What are you using the money to? What are you spending your money on? Have you set priorities? I think it's important for parents to ask simple, straightforward questions. The child may not have the types of answers that the parents want, but it will at least start them to think about these things.
Well, you know, I have to tell you that, and I'm sure you know this, that a lot of people would just find this very conversation ridiculous, you know, because in a lot of cultures, it's just assumed that a child is going to turn that paycheck over to the parents.
I mean, that's just
an assumption. So even if you are not part of that kind of mindset, do you think that parents should enforce savings? I mean, do you advise parents to make it a rule?
Yes, I do advise parents to make it a rule, but don't be surprised if your child decides to rebel in some way, in some small way, to show their independence. But I do think it's a rule. But I was raised where I had to contribute to the household. When I got my first job, my mother made it imperative that I had to give her part of my money. And I did not like that at all. But from that, I learned a very, very important lesson that became useful to me many years later, and that was about how to allocate my money. My mother and I, we would often just sit there and I would steam when I would have to give her my money that I had worked so hard for. But in the long term, it did prove to be a very, very good lesson about how to allocate my money toward necessities and then use the rest of it to get some of the things that I wanted.
I'm wondering if you have some opinion about how much of that should go into kind of the family pot. I mean, because some kids literally do turn over the entire paycheck. I mean, do you think that that's okay? Or do you think that kids should, this is kind of a lesson for parents now, do you think that you should allow the child to have some of that money for himself or herself?
I think it's fair to allow the child to have some of that money for themselves. After all, they're going out, they're doing the work, they should have some of the reward from that. My mother would have argued, your reward is living in my house. And I understood that. But over time, we negotiated it, so I did get to keep some of the money. And I think that's fairer to the child.
How much? And also, how much? You have a
I think
rule
you negotiate that? That. No. I think you negotiate that depending upon the family's needs in the end and how much you think the child will need day to day. So letting the child keep a quarter of that money or half of that money seems to me within the realm of reason. Anything less than a quarter or 20% seems almost churlish and unfair to the child who's actually going out and doing the hard work.
What about the other side of that question, which is families who are affluent, who don't need the child to contribute to his or her basic support? Do you have some thoughts about how that should be handled? I mean, I know a lot of kids, for example, you know, my working assumption is a lot of kids, what they want that summer job for. I mean, some kids, look, it's clear you are saving for college. You may not be saving for food and shelter, but you're definitely saving for college.
Yes.
But for kids for whom that's maybe not as pressing a concern, do you have an opinion about how that money should be spent or what kinds of conversations those families should be having about that money?
I do have an opinion about this because I have several friends who have children who are in exactly this situation. The parents are very well-to-do. They work on Wall Street. They own companies. So the child saving for college is not an issue. What they mostly talk about is, what are your priorities? What do you want to buy with this money? What goals do you have with this money? And they sit down with the children and they talk about what things are important to you to buy with this money. If they want to use it to go to concerts, that's fine. If they wanted to use it to take a trip with friends or a field trip, that's fine. But they have the children set some goals, both short-term goals for the summer and perhaps some longer-term goals, so they have a little money sitting there for opportunities that come up during the school year that the child may want, but the parents may not want to pay for.
Do have to ask you, though, about that people who might be listening to our conversation and might be saying, you know what, I'm not that good with money either.
Michelle, when you mentioned this, I had this completely autobiographical flashback to my childhood. My mother once inherited some money, and within 6 to 8 weeks, the money was gone. I still remember my grandmother looking at my mother and just shaking her head that my mother had spent all this money. My mother was very bad at handling money. And sometimes it's best for you, the child, to look at another relative. So I looked at my grandmother, I looked at an uncle, and I looked at a family friend who was a better person at managing money. And sometimes I would actually talk to my grandmother about, why do you think my mama is so bad with money? And my grandmother would say, she doesn't like to think about it. But you need to learn to think about money. So it was from those simple lessons by looking at family, friends, and other people in your community that you can learn good takeaways.
That was author and financial educator Alvin Hall. We spoke with him from New York City. Let's turn to an issue in social media now. If you were a Facebook user in January of 2012, you might remember logging on, scrolling through your news feed and feeling especially upbeat or maybe a little more down than usual. If so, you are not alone. Back then, Facebook's data scientists manipulated the news feed. More than 600,000 unwitting users were shown either mostly upbeat or more depressing news stories in an effort to determine if this affected their moods. Facebook recently published their findings, but a lot of people are not liking this experiment. We wanted to talk about it, so we called Ray Junco. He's a fellow at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard. And Adrienne LaFrance is a senior associate editor at The Atlantic, and she wrote about the study and people's reaction to it. Welcome to you both. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks, Michelle.
Adrienne, you wrote that there was something new level creepy about this study, but you were also trying to figure out, because you pointed out that, you know, we know that the news feeds are curated or manipulated by somebody, and you were trying to investigate what it is that felt new level creepy about it. So what'd you come up with?
I think there's a number of issues to unpack here, and one of them is sort of the extent to which this manipulation has to do with consent. So it's sort of an ethical question as well as a legal question, but I thought it was telling. One of the authors who works at Facebook posted a statement over the weekend, something to the effect of, you know, we're just trying to better give you what you want. And to me, there's a real contradiction there in them saying, we're trying to give you what you want, but, you know, we're not even going to give you the chance to give consent to let us know.
So the first issue was they didn't ask people whether they were willing to, you know, participate in this. But what else? Is it the emotional manipulation, trying to sort of evaluate your feelings as opposed to what you're interested in? Is that what you think?
Yeah. I think so. I mean, yes, there is a contextual question here. So people are accustomed to being manipulated with the messages of, say, like an advertiser, for instance. But when you go to your Facebook page, unless you've read the terms of service extensively, or even if you have, frankly, you're not necessarily going to understand that there's sort of this puppet master on the other side affecting what you see with the purpose of trying to see if it makes you happier or more sad.
Ray Junco, what's your reaction to this study? What was your reaction to it?
Well, my reaction was, ooh, I have to take a look and let me see. But it's clear that there was so much that at least wasn't thought of when planning the study. Cornell released a statement saying that they took a look, and what was told to them was that the researcher was using pre-existing data, so they didn't need to do a review. I mean, the data was already there. Facebook said that their internal review process, which clearly wasn't enough because they really didn't plan on what would happen if this would adversely affect people. I think the thing that bugs me the most about it is that you're toying with people's psychological states. That could have some pretty significant consequences. I mean, imagine if somebody who is depressed, who is going on Facebook to garner support from some friends, is exposed to a more negative news feed. They're probably more likely to be even more depressed because of that. So they really didn't consider how the risk-reward balance, which you have to do ethically when you're planning a study. You have to purposefully and thoroughly consider the risk inherent in the study and whether that risk is justified given what you might find. And then you also have to put in place protections for people who might experience some negative effects.
Adrian, you contacted Susan Fiske, who edited the study before it was printed in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences of America, and presumably you asked her these questions about what ethical considerations were made before utilizing this technique. What did she say in response to these questions?
This is actually an area where some confusion emerged, because when I first talked to her, she described a process in which, when the paper first crossed her desk, it raised some concerns for her, and so she went back to the authors and asked them about what kind of review process the paper had gone through. And her understanding was that it had been held to the scrutiny of a local institutional review board. And what that means is an institutional review board, or IRB, a lot of people call them, are boards that consider the ethics and sort of hold research to a standard, particularly when human subjects are involved. And so at first it seemed, from my conversation with her, as though there was this level of scrutiny. And then later it came out that no, a university IRB, or institutional review board, hadn't been used. And in fact, Facebook used an internal review process, the details of which are not public and don't appear to be anywhere near being made public, given Facebook's reluctance to talk in detail about this.
So, Ray, is the issue for users is that you think you're creating a news feed based on your interests, and then you find out that actually the person on the other end is deciding what you see based on, what, a desire to affect your mood, right? And that's different from, say, advertising, where you turn on your favorite show and you realize that the advertisers are trying to get you to buy something. That's the point of advertising, right? Mm-hmm. Or to do something, which is the point of political advertising. And in this instance, you're being manipulated, but you don't know why. Is that really kind of the issue here?
Yeah, I think that's it. I mean, hey, we live in a very consumerist society. We're kind of used to this, right? We're kind of used to billboards and advertising pushing us to buy a product. But this isn't about buying a product. This is about messing with people's emotions. I mean, I don't want to blow this out of proportion. Their effect sizes were small. However, that being said, the Facebook team had little way of knowing that the effect sizes were going to be small. So you know, before the fact, they should have planned this out. So I think people are justifiably upset because they are messing with your emotions without your permission. I mean, you know, who needs more drama in their life, right?
Unless you want it, unless you're seeking the drama.
Hey, if that's
your
thing,
you know.
Which
can turn on scandal. Adrian, what's Facebook's response to this? As I mentioned, that when you talked to Susan Fiske, who edited the study, she said that this is really Facebook's issue to decide how they are allowing people to look at their data. So what did Facebook have to say about this?
Facebook has issued a couple of statements, including a public statement from one of the authors of the study who's a Facebook employee. But they haven't, at least to me, and I know several other reporters at other outlets, they haven't been willing to answer follow-up questions asking for more specifics. So they've really circled the wagons. One of the things that keeps sort of sticking out to me is a quote from the study that they found they were able to lead people to experience the same emotions without their awareness. So sort of taking a step back from this specific study, to know that a company like Facebook, who doesn't have necessarily much interest in giving public disclosure about its intentions, is trying to lead people to experience emotions without their awareness, I think that raises much larger concerns, especially when they have access to data about everybody at levels that we don't fully understand.
Do you think that there will be consequences going forward now that this has come too late?
Well, I mean, Facebook's stock price was not affected. So it doesn't appear to be hurting the company in the immediate short term. You know, I'm hopeful that it will launch a larger conversation, and an overdue one, about data use and data privacy and the intersection of these companies that actually wield enormous power over information but don't adhere to ethics in the professional sense that we as journalists might think, or even federal regulations that academics are scrutinized to. So hopefully the conversation will continue, but, you know, it's hard to say if Facebook has any incentive to change.
Ray Hunko, what about you? What do you think there will be consequences as a result of this?
I hope so. I hope that Facebook and other technology companies will implement more stringent independent reviews of their research. I think it's important for these companies to understand the power they hold over their users, and that when you are doing social science research, that you should follow the same ethics as other social science researchers, as the ethics recommended by the federal government, and even ethics that are not recommended by the federal government, just the basic ethical principles of doing no harm.
Well, wait, can I just push on this for 1 second, though? What do you say to those who argue that, first of all, users are giving their consent to these kinds of experiments when they sign up for Facebook and then they click the I agree on the user agreement, which is very expansive. And other people who say, well, you know, maybe I as a journalist don't agree with this statement, but a lot of people feel that there are certain cable channels who are doing the same thing, in essence, that they are stacking their story selection in an effort to achieve a certain response in their viewers. Mm-hmm. So what's the difference?
Well, I think I certainly wouldn't suggest that we limit the ability of companies to analyze their data. I think where we need to draw the line is when there is a manipulation of something about the user, what they might feel, what they might experience, if there is a possibility of some negative effect, that needs to be thought through and there need to be some kind of protections in place.
Ray Junco is an associate professor in the School of Education at Iowa State University. He's a fellow at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard. We go to him often to talk about matters related to the internet and society and social media. Adrian LaFrance is a senior associate editor at The Atlantic. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thanks Michelle.
So much for having us.
Coming up, summer is a time for sun and fun, but it can also be a time of dread for many who are worried that their bodies aren't swimsuit ready. And that fear may be settling in at younger and younger ages. Our parenting panel steps in with some savvy advice on how to start the conversation about weight, nutrition, and body image with your children and how to keep it going. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Fleischman Hillard, a global communications firm specializing in public relations, public affairs, marketing, and social media. FleischmanHillard.com. From Carnegie Corporation, supporting the New Americans campaign and all their partners promoting citizenship. More at greatimmigrants.carnegie.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
Support for WILL comes from Subaru of Champaign County, featuring the standard all-wheel drive Subaru Outback with an EPA highway rating of 29 mpg, depending on conditions. More information is available at their showroom on Route 45 in Savoy or at SubaruofChampaign.com.
PRI's The World brings you more than just a day's news.
Yeah, I had an interview once, and the guy said, so what was it like taking the cameras to your village and the elders seeing these cameras for the first time? You know, these soul-capturing contraptions, you know, how did they feel about that? You know, we've had TV there for like 60 years.
I'm Marco Werman. Join us and hear The World.
Weekday afternoons at 3 on AM 580.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. They say it takes a village to raise a child, but maybe you just need a few moms and dads in your corner. Every week, we check in with a diverse group of parents for their common sense and savvy advice. And as a holiday weekend is coming up, let's assume that many families are planning to celebrate the 4th of July with some beach and pool time. But swimsuit season can be rough, even for children, especially girls who worry about their weight or how their bodies look. In fact, nearly two-thirds of 13-year-old girls are afraid of gaining weight. That according to a study published recently in the Journal of Adolescent Health. So we thought this would be a good time to talk about helping children have a healthy attitude about weight, nutrition, and body image. So we're joined now by Carol Weston. She's a columnist with Girls Life magazine and the author of Girl Talk, All the Stuff Your Sister Never Told You. She's also a mom of two, and she's with us from our bureau in New York. Welcome, Carol Weston. Thanks for coming.
Thank you for inviting me.
Also joining us is Dani Tucker. She's one of our regular contributors to our Parenting Roundtable. She's a mom of two and a fitness instructor. Dani's here in Washington, D.C., along with Karen Schachter. She's a licensed social worker and founder of Dishing With Your Daughter. That's an organization committed to helping mothers and daughters make healthier food choices. And she's also a mom of two. Welcome to you both. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
So, Carol, I'm going to start with you. As an advice columnist, how many questions do you generally get that have to do with things like, you know, weight and body image? How do I look?
Wow, I would say almost half of them. I mean, it's extraordinary. I've been the advice columnist at Girls Life for 20 years, and a lot of questions are about friendships and boys and parents. But after that, it's really body. It's weight, it's puberty, it's breast size, it's skin.
Has that changed over the years? Have you seen more preoccupation with weight as people? Maybe the celebrity culture has gotten more kind of. There have always been celeb magazines, right? But but now you've got like cable channels and things devoted to style and fashion and blogs and all that other stuff. Have you seen a change over the years?
I almost want to say no. I think girls have always worried more than they really should and need to about weight. But of course, what has changed in the last 20 years and 30 years is that childhood obesity has more than doubled. And let me get this right. Childhood obesity has more than doubled in children and quadrupled in adolescents in the past 30 years. That's according to the CDC. So while we worry about the statistic you had, Michelle, mm-hmm. about we don't want girls to worry about their weight, but we also don't want them to head down difficult paths. And that's why it's so hard for parents. We don't want the kids' self-esteem to suffer, but we don't want the child's health to suffer either.
Dani, you're a fitness instructor. I know this is a concern of yours as well, which has been partly why you started your business. What's the main concern that your clients have?
Just getting healthy and just getting on the right track. And one reason our policy is your kids work out with you free, 15 and under. They don't have to pay because that's the way you develop healthy habits with them. I worked out with my grandmother and my mother when I was little. They used to take me to aerobic classes with them. As long as, you know, there are many classes that are, you know, kid-friendly. And, you know, we took what we like to do, dance. And basically what I did was took that and started the business to the music that I knew would get us up. And because of it, they can work out with their kids.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's been your policy from the beginning.
From the beginning,
really,
yeah.
Because why? What motivated that? Is it because that was just the way you grew up?
Because it saved my life.
Save your life now, tell me.
Because if my parents, like you said, I mean, we the kids, we have a tendency to be weight conscious, but when we were kids, what we didn't have was weight knowledge. What do we do about it? You know, you didn't have a lot of education on what to eat and what not to eat, you know what I mean, and exercise. They don't teach you a lot of that. I know they didn't with us now. I mean, back then. I know they do now, but when I was growing up, they didn't talk about those things. So I did it with my parents, with my mother and my grandmother. You know, and we always did it together. And I get on the front and dance my butt up, but that's what I like to do. Mm-hmm. So I never forgot that because I struggled with my weight growing up. I struggled big time with my weight growing up. And if it wasn't for my mother and grandmother taking me to work out with them, I don't know where I'd be. You know, so and that's why when I started my business, I remembered that I want them to, and I love it. My youngest is three. Our youngest student is three, and she dances with her mother all over the place, and it's beautiful.
That's awesome. Karen, what about you? Your group is called Dishing With Your Daughter, so I had two questions for you, which
sure.
The same question I asked the other ladies, which is, what's the most common question you get? Because I'm assuming it's parents who are the ones
Absolutely.
Who are contacting you, so what's the most common question that you get? And secondly, is it just daughters now, or is it sons too? Are they also concerned about weight?
Yeah, the answer to the first question is the most common question I get is, how do I help my daughter be healthy maybe even lose weight without messing her up. Because many of the moms that I see and that I've worked with struggled themselves. They either struggled with their weight from the time they were young, or they struggled with an eating disorder. And so they want to help their daughters, but they and their sons, but I see mostly women and girls. So they want to help their daughters, but they want to do it in a way that is not hurtful and that is actually helpful and supportive. They don't want to lead them down the same path that they felt they were led down.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with we're having our weekly parenting conversation. We're talking about kids and body image. Joining us are licensed social worker, nutritional consultant Karen Schachter, fitness instructor Danny Tucker, and Girls Life Advice columnist Carol Weston. So I just want to ask you this whole question, Karen. I'll start with you on this one. This whole question of what to say. You know, it's a common thing that girls will say, am I fat, or do these pants make me look fat? And what's the answer to that? Because I think a lot of parents' instinct is to say, no matter what the truth is, oh, no,
right.
You know, no, princess.
You're beautiful.
You
look perfect.
Princess. You're perfect.
You're perfect. That is parents. We want to make our kids feel good, so we want to reassure them. The problem with that is that, A, if your daughter does have a problem, she knows you're lying. She already knows she has a problem, and she's coming to you for help, for support, for guidance. And if she doesn't have a problem and she continues to ask whether she's fat or she puts down her body, there's something else going on. She needs to have a conversation. So you actually need to talk about this as you would talk about anything, as you would talk about alcohol or drugs or bullying. So you need to ask questions.
And what would you say?
So
how would you start
that? I would say
that
to my daughter, tell me what's going on. Tell me what you're wondering. Tell me why you think this. I would ask a question that is more than a yes or no, that gives more than a yes or no answer. And I would, first of all, put my judgment and fear and shame aside, because many of us, if we have struggled ourselves, or just simply because we live in this culture that makes fat this shameful, terrible thing, so many of us are carrying around this fear. So we're so afraid to say anything like, oh, no, no, no. So we put our judgment aside, and then we ask those open-ended questions, and we listen. Mm-hmm. We listen to what they say, and then we empathize. That must be so hard that you're feeling that way. Mm-hmm. How can I support you?
Carol, I think you're also a fan of this, too. I know you wrote a column about raising concerns about the fact that you think too many parents are actually ignoring weight issues among their kids. Talk a little bit about your perspective on this.
Well, some parents are a little bit in denial about, let me just say I love your panelists. I love everything they've said. I'm just nodding here in the studio in New York. But yes, there are parents who don't seem to be as aware as we wish they would be that they've got a toddler or a five-year-old who is already got a big old weight problem that is not going to be easy for that boy or that girl to navigate for the rest of their days. So I feel that because when a kid is at risk, he's with weight, it's not just appearance, it's not just superficial. It's, it becomes a health concern. You're at greater risk for diabetes, for cardiovascular troubles. So we want to be open-eyed and clear-eyed and always compassionate and kind and sensitive and respectful. I feel that that part goes without saying, but the advice, you know, I advise tweens and kids and teenagers. If an adult says to me, do you think I should go on Match.com? I'd say, gosh, maybe. If a kid writes me and says, I'm thinking of, you know, I met this boy online, I go, no, don't meet boys online. So when girls write me, it's not just about their caring mom who says, oh, you're beautiful the way you are. Way too many girls, it's heartbreaking how many girls have written me to say, you know, my dad said I'm fat, and they're words I can't even say on the air, or I don't think I can. But, you know, there are parents out there who are not supportive and who aren't as loving as we wish. So we have to support the kids. But I guess in general, I believe the takeaway for parents listening is do it with love and respect. And also you can say, you know what, we could probably both be in a little bit better shape. I think you look great and you are my best kid or whatever, big hug, but I could probably get in better shape too. So it's sort of what Danny said. Let's
do it,
you know, let's work out together, or let's take a walk together.
Danny, I have to ask you though about something. There's some culture here involved too, because I'm thinking about the fact that this whole question of like what women are supposed to look like, there's a lot of politics involved in that. Like a lot of people will remember the whole issue with former talk show host, you know, Don Imus, who made these disparaging comments about Venus and Serena Williams and their physicality. And a lot of people were very offended by that because they're not, you know, they're not stick thin. and why should they be? And they're clearly, you know, fit. So the question I have, you know, for you is particularly, you know, you and I are both African American, and I think a lot of times, you know, feeling that the culture doesn't necessarily appreciate, you know, the body type. On the other hand, statistics show that African American and Latina women are also more likely to be carrying excess weight. So how do you navigate that with your in your family and also with your clients when they raise these issues?
Balance, because bottom line, excuse me, for like you said, African-American and Latino girls, we tend to be thick and fit. And honestly, let's keep it real, we're thick and fit because that's the way our men like it. They want meat on the bones. I mean, that's just the African-American man. 90% of them want some meat on the bones. So what people call skinny, we don't like. Well, you know what I'm saying? You know, my doctor always tells me, you got weight to lose. I'm all right. You know? So our thing is thick and fit. The balance is this. Don't go to Golden Corral 7 times a week. You understand what I'm saying? And that's what we focus on is the balance, because we know you're going to be thick.
You Golden want, Corral being an all-you-can-eat buffet for people who are not aware of its charms.
Thank you. Okay. our difference is getting them to understand what PHAT means. Fat. That fat. You know, it is pretty hot and tempting, and it also has a slang thing that I can't say right now.
Let's not do that.
But
yeah.
At the same time, balance, because it can also lead you to diabetes. You understand what I'm saying? A heart attack and stroke. You can be thick. You can be thick and fit. When, you know, when they come to my classes and they see these quote-unquote thick and fit women moving the way they're moving, yes, they are healthy. They don't have to be a size 2. To be healthy, you can be healthy and fit a size 14. I am one sitting right here.
Okay. All right. Karen, final thought from you. You also had some word of wisdom about how to talk about food, correct? You're saying don't ban ad. Tell us about that.
Yes. I mean, I agree with everything Danny just said. I mean, weight does not determine health. Health determines health. And so we want to, A, focus on health. We don't want to put our kids on a diet, because diet is all about deprivation. And deprivation makes us want to eat something more. And oftentimes, many of the women I work with who have struggled for years and years started their diet when they were teens, and they're going on and on. So, and it's been a problem. So what we want to do is we want to help our kids get healthy. We want to start adding in foods that balance their body, balance their brain chemistry, reduce cravings. We want to take out the processed stuff that's very addictive and compelling and marketed really well to kids and families. And
okay. So, and Carol, final thought from you. You have a rule on S's. Quickly tell me that. We have about 30 seconds left. It's no what?
Well, we'll try to cut back on sweets, snacks, seconds, and soda. And honestly, if parents could have water in the house and not have sugary soda at home, that would be just make a huge breakthrough.
Okay. Sweets. Tell me again. One more time. Sweets.
Oh, sweets.
Snacks.
Seconds.
Snacks. And soda.
And soda.
All right.
And it's not, again, it's not deprivation. I mean, I have a cookie, but I don't buy a whole lot of cookies. I don't buy a whole pack of, and I don't buy any Doritos, Cheetos, Fritos, Oreos. No O's.
All right. No O's either. Okay. Carol Weston is a columnist with Girls Life magazine, a mom of two. Danny Tucker is a mom of two and a fitness instructor. Karen Schechter is founder of Dishing With Your Daughter, also a mom of two. Ladies, thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And finally, it's time for the feature we call In Your Ear. That's the part of the program where we typically ask some of the guests what they listen to. But as this program winds down, our last broadcast is scheduled for August 1st, we thought it would be nice to hear what members of our staff are listening to, what they're playing when they aren't producing our groundbreaking show, of course. So to start us off, let's hear the musical selections of one of our original and longest-serving staff members, our director. Here's what's playing in his ear.
Hi, I'm Arjun Hutchins. I am the director of Tell Me More. I've been here from the very beginning. I think it's been 7 years. I was here when the show had no name. It was just called Rough Cuts. And here's what's playing in my ear. It's important that I give credit to one of the songs that inspired me to do what I do as a producer. And that song was by Stevie Wonder. It's called I Believe.
Shattered dreams, worthless years, here am I encased inside a hollow shell. Life began, then was done, now I stare into a cold and empty well.
I get emotional every time I hear the song. Stevie created this excellent song that, you know, made me interested in creating audio, creating content for people to hear. Because I was thinking to myself, like, he could convey this type of emotion through a recorded medium, then maybe I can too.
I believe when I fall in love with you, it will be forever.
The next song I'm listening to is a song by Jimi Hendrix. It's called Bold as Love. The part that I like the most is about 2 minutes and 40 seconds in. It starts off very quiet, and then you just hear this drum, boom, 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 boom. And then it just goes off in this kind of explosion. It's almost as if he was creating some sort of like big bang of music. The last song that I'm listening to is from J. Cole's album, Born Sinner, and it's called Runaway.
On the inside, color they faces. Wise words from an indecent man made me reflect on the times when we was 3/5 of them and chains and powerless. Brave souls reduced to cowardice. Slaving in the baking sun for hours just to see the master creeping to the shack where your lady at. 9 months later, got a baby that's not quite what you expected, but you refuse to neglect it. Cause you know your wife, he love you, thus you refuse to accept it. That's the type that should tell my granny light skin.
Rich. The song has lots of stories in it, and he very eloquently goes through all these different stories. It's just worth listening to. He makes them very relatable.
Like Dave Chappelle, you know, run away, run away. Run away, run away. I'm holding on desperately. Run away, run away, run away, run away. I'm holding on.
That was Tell Me More director Arjun Hutchins telling us what's playing in his ear. That's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.